you very much, I believe. It's actually a real pleasure to be in beautiful Western Massachusetts. I thought I would title this lecture this way just to be a little bit provocative, and I see that the Kahn Institute organizers have put together an aptly seasonal poster that reminds me of the people walking around town in their costumes. I'm not amplified enough. Maybe I need to bend down a bit. How's that? Okay, so I'm going to, in the next hour or so, give a brief introduction to the health in the U.S. from a social epidemiologist perspective. Our starting point is this league table of life expectancy at birth in the 23 countries of the OECD. That's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. That's the, if you will, the club of rich countries in the world. And as you look at this chart, you'll see that Japan, which is the country where I was born, currently ranks number one in average life expectancy at birth. Many of you would notice the funny accent. I speak with a funny accent, and that's because I spent much of my youth in New Zealand. My family moved from Japan to New Zealand, and that explains my odd accent. And you see that in New Zealand, for example, the life expectancy is shorter than in Japan, but it's in the top half of the pack. And then the country where I've been living for the last 18 years is the United States. And so we call this, in my business, downward health mobility. I suppose, actually, the interesting thing about this chart is that when I teach this course that Benita mentioned at the Harvard School of Public Health, even in an audience of over 200 public health students, I would say that less than half are aware of the actual position of the United States in the OECD health rankings. About half the class assume that we must be in the top half, if not number one. Many people don't know that if among the OECD countries, the only countries that have worse life expectancy are the Czech Republic, Mexico, Poland, Slovak, Hungary, and Turkey. That's how bad you poorly we look. Now, some of you may be thinking, what is this big deal with the life expectancy difference between 82.1 and 77.8? You'll notice that I've truncated the chart here, so in part I'm lying with statistics. If I drew the horizontal axis all the way to zero and blew it up, it wouldn't look so impressive. And many people who don't are not familiar with life expectancy calculations may be thinking, well, this is like the difference between having a choice between dying at 77.8 versus 82.1, and that doesn't sound very exciting. But of course, that's a horrible misunderstanding of how life expectancy data are calculated. This is not the mean age at death, it's the average life expectancy difference at birth. And demographers, of course, know that this is a huge difference. The actual difference of 4.3 years in average life expectancy is like saying, if you think about the amount of time it took the United States to add the last 4.3 years to get to 77.8, it took us three decades. Right. So another way of saying it, turning it around, is if we go based upon historical gains in life expectancy that we've experienced in the U.S. in the last 30 years, it would take us three decades to catch up to where Japan is currently. That's how far apart we are. We look really sick based on average population health data. If we eliminated all heart attack and stroke in this country, we might improve life expectancy by a couple of years. That's how large these differences are at the population level. Now, I know, many of you, if you haven't traveled in other countries or lived in other places like I have, then maybe you might think that, we're not doing so poorly, and this might be a bit of an exaggeration. There's more to life than how long you live, and there's also the quality of life as well. So what I'm going to do showing a little case study, which I call The Tale of Two Countries. I'm going to show you a detailed comparison of the health status of two countries, the United States and the United Kingdom. UK is currently just below the bottom of the pack of OECD countries, US really near the bottom. And this comparison has been made easier for me because someone published a paper about it. In the Journal of the American Medical Association, Michael Marmots, who's a leading social epidemiologist, among others, did a comparison of two comparable national surveys in England compared to the US to compare their health statistics. Now, these are the two studies. It's a very narrow age range, 55 to 64 year olds. So wash out for the moment, confounding by age differences. So in the US, the National Survey is the Health and Retirement Survey. In England, it's the English Longitudinal Study of Aging, also known as ELSA. Now, many of you, no doubt, when you see charts like this, the immediate thing that comes to mind is, well, in this country, we have enormous race and ethnic heterogeneity because of the historical injustices to African-American populations, that Black Americans have a shorter life expectancy compared to white Americans, and that maybe this is part of the reason why America appears to be so low on the league tables. That's partly the truth, but what I'm going to show you is abstracting that away for a moment. So we're going to limit the comparison of the health of these two countries just to white people. And so this will show you who's comparing, as far as we can, like people with other like people. So here's, we'll cut to the chase, and here's the results of the two surveys. And these are the self-reported prevalences, self-reported number of people who say that on the survey they have been told by their doctor that they have diabetes, hypertension, they've had a history of heart attack or stroke. And you see that in every category, the Americans fare much worse compared to English people. The life expectancy data are based on mortality. So a lot of it's heavily weighted by infant mortality. But when you look in middle ages, and at older ages, and when you ask about self-reported morbid conditions, you see that Americans have twice the prevalence of diabetes, much higher prevalence of hypertension, more likely to have had a heart attack, and more likely to have a stroke. These are all highly significant differences. Now, if you've been trained in the health arena, you would say, I don't like this phrase here, self-reported, because how do we know that we can trust what people say they've been told that they have diagnosis on a telephone interview? You have to have a certain amount of medical knowledge to even know that you have any of these conditions. The other thing is that, of course, you have to have access to a physician in order to be told that you have hypertension or diabetes. There are many people walking around in the community with undiagnosed hypertension and diabetes. Perhaps they've had a stroke and they don't know about it. It has to be a minor one, of course. But and if we can take that into account, what would be the direction of the bias, if you will, in comparing the conditions between these two countries? If I turn the question around, I'm saying, if these conditions are partly dependent on having access to a primary care physician who will clap a sphygmomanometer on your arm to measure your blood pressure every time you walk in, so that you know whether you have hypertension or not, if we take account of that national difference, in which country would it be more likely that these diseases would occur? I mean, if you pause to think about this for a moment, we know that in the UK, everybody has access to the National Health Service. And in the United States, 1 in 7 Americans are uninsured. That's what the whole congressional debate is about at the moment. So if we took that into account, I would imagine that these differences are even larger than they are. I'm guessing there are many more Americans walking around in the community who have not had their blood pressure measured or their hemoglobin A1C measured, and they don't know that they have diabetes. So these are probably underestimates of how far apart people are in the two countries. Now, some of you may still be skeptical that these self-reported differences are untrustworthy. So in the same paper, they also measured objective biomarkers of disease risk. You can take blood samples from people and analyze those blood samples for measures like C-reactive protein, which is an inflammatory marker. It's one of these new tests that have come that tells you whether you have underlying inflammation. And if you have high levels of these, you're at increased risk of having a heart attack or stroke. If you look at fibrinogen, that's a clotting factor. The higher levels you have of that, the more likely you are to have a blood clot in your coronary vessels or your cerebral arteries. And if you have low HDL cholesterol, that's a good cholesterol. You don't want to have that. And if you compare on England and the USA on all these measures, you see that the self-reports don't lie. The Americans appear to be much sicker compared to people in England. So I am at least persuaded that the life expectancy data are not telling a misleading story. Americans really do appear sicker than the English. Now, when we say what could explain these national differences in health status, I can think of, at least the people in my field think of four or five explanations. Number one is that it's because of the differences in access to health care, right? The National Health Service, everyone's has access. U.S. We still can't cover one in six individuals. The second category of explanation is lifestyle differences, differences in smoking, diet, physical activity, whatever. Next one is genetic differences between people in England compared to those in the U.S. And then very lastly, my own field, which is the difference in the social environment. And you're laughing because the font size here is not accidental. I've blown it up in proportion to the amount of space that is occupied by each of these topics in public discourse. So you see when President Obama talks about a plan to improve the health of the nation, 90% of the discourse is about improving access to health care and not about the other stuff. And so I'm going to try to persuade you to change the way that you view what really drives population health by the end of this hour. So let's go through each of these. I came across sounding like I was knocking healthcare, but of course, I'm being originally a physician, I don't believe that for a moment healthcare is actually extremely important in terms of assuring people's health. And if we look at the OECD countries, there's a strong relationship between how much money each country spends in the aggregate on medical care versus the average life expectancy. Each of these diamonds represents one of those OECD countries I showed at the beginning, and the horizontal axis is how much money they spent in healthcare activities, adjusting for purchasing power parity and put into the same US currency. So you see there's a strong relationship between how much effort each country spends on healthcare and how long their citizens live. But don't get me wrong. I think healthcare is extremely important, but it's not the only thing that matters, because what I forgot to add was the U.S. So this is these are the 22 OECD countries, and I'm just adding where the U.S. is. So if healthcare matters so much, how come we're not number one? That's the 2x4 explanation. The U.S. Currently spends roughly twice to almost three times as much as countries like the UK or Japan, and yet purchases a level of health that's much worse than any other of these OECD countries. Another way of saying this is that if we believe this regression line to be true, then the US health should be somewhere up here, above more than 86 years, and yet we're closer to 77 point whatever. So that's one thing to note. The other thing is that usually by this time I get interrupted by someone who's very upset because they've spent a lot of time thinking about healthcare, and they say, well, wait a minute, you just said one in seven Americans lack access to health insurance, whereas everybody in England is covered by the National Health Service. So maybe you know, it's unfair, really, to make these generalizations based upon aggregate expenditure on healthcare. You know, maybe Americans would have better health if our health dollars were spread out more equitably. You know, so it's not, we can't just judge the performance of health based on how much money we spend in total, but if we could spread those dollars more equitably, then maybe our life expectancy would be much better. I think that's partly true, but I also have some reasons to doubt that. And the reason why I say that is because when we look in greater detail across, let's say, income groups in England compared to the USA, here's what the picture looks like. So what I'm showing here is the English and Americans broken out into tertiles of income. So these are low-income English and Americans, middle-income, high-income. And then I'm showing their diabetes prevalence. And I'm doing the same here for hypertension. If you look at this for a moment, I think it's currently true that 97% of Americans in the top income, top third of income distribution, already have access to health insurance. 97%. So for these high-income Americans, lack of access to insurance is not the issue. And yet, if you look at their diabetes prevalence, it's actually worse than the bottom third of people in England. I mean, you look at the richest third of Americans, none of who lack health insurance, their prevalence of hypertension is as bad as the bottom third of people in England. That's how far apart we are. Another way of saying this is that if and when Congress manages to cover everyone with access to health insurance, this is about as, the bottom third of English is about as good as, that's how far apart these two countries are. There's another interesting thought experiment. You might consider what would happen if we, all of a sudden exported, if England decided to export the bottom third of its income distribution, the people in the bottom third, to America. If you did that, that would improve the life expectancy of both countries. That's how far. You can think about that. Thought about suggesting this to President Obama. It's a win-win situation. So how about lifestyle? Healthcare is important, but it's not the answer why Americans' life is so short, brutish, and nasty. How about lifestyle? We have data on suspects like smoking and heavy drinking. It ain't smoking because the English do a little bit more than the Americans. And when it comes to heavy drinking, the English are by far away. And any of you who have spent a semester abroad in England, I think you would agree. You just go to any English town on the weekend and you see catastrophic levels of public drunkenness. You don't see in America. So those two are not the answers. How about diet? Could it be that the English live longer, they have less diabetes because their diet is so much better than the American diet? As I always think about that, I can't remember the last time I had a nutritious meal in England. I'm not going to just leave it at insulting the English. I have some data. These are pictorial data. There's a rather interesting coffee table book called The Hungry Planet. I don't know how many people have seen it here, but basically Peter Menzel, who's a San Francisco photographer, has gone into 30-odd countries of the world, from the most developed to the poorest, and he's photographed people's lifestyle habits, specifically their diet. And in every country he goes into, what he specifically does is to ask a typical family of that country to pose in front of a week's worth of food. And so in my field of nutritional epidemiology, what we have here is a visual, 1 week diet record. When nutritional epidemiologists ask about, try to measure diet, we ask people to keep a 1 week diary of everything they ate. But here we have a pictorial record that's an instant snapshot of people's dietary habits. So here's the Cavan family from California, Craig, Regan, his wife, and their two kids. And you see, you look at the surface area of week's worth of food. The one thing that stands out from a public health perspective is that this family is not conforming to the Surgeon General's recommendation to consume 4 or 5 servings of fresh fruits and vegetables a day. You know? Because if you look at the whole surface area, the only part that looks green is this tiny corner of some broccoli and some frozen peas. And they have some fruit and so forth, but by far and away the largest surface area is taken up with pizza, sugared breakfast cereals, corn dogs, meat products. And you see this, each of these, this is about as tall as this man's head. What does that mean? If you drink one of these, that's about 500 kilocalories right there. That means, for most of you, you have to run for an hour to work that off. And then there are 4 of these stacked up. So we already know the American diet, is terrible. But the question is it worse than the English diet? And I don't see any evidence that that's the case. If you look at the Bainton family in the same book, this is from Wiltshire, there's Mark, Deborah, their 2 sons. You see that over a week's worth of food provisions, again, a tiny corner is devoted to fresh produce. There's some Brussels sprouts here, a tomato, and some fruit. But then you have masses of candy. It's hard to believe that these kids would eat so much candy. And we have the pizza here. We have the, I think this is for the dog, actually. You'd have to be a very brave person to suggest that the English and Americans have a different health status because of the diet quality. If you had said to me that the Japanese live long partly because of their diet, I could almost believe it. There might be some contribution. If you look at the Japanese family in this photo book, this is the Matsuda family from Okinawa. Takeo, who's 88, his wife Keiko, who's 75, the mother Kama, who's 100. You see, over a week's worth of food provisions, it looks, it completely looks different quality in terms of the color. The half of it is devoted to fresh vegetables, and the other half, these are all fish products. They look like meat, but they're actually fish. So if you eat a diet that comprises of half vegetable and half fish, you might get closer to the Japanese average. But I think the point of this is that the reason why Americans have such bad life expectancies, not entirely because of the diet. I think one difference that does stand out in the England to U.S. comparison is body mass and specifically obesity. Americans have much more of it. And the difference in obesity could, of course, partly explain differences in hypertension, diabetes, heart attack, and stroke, because these are all, obesity is a major risk factor for all of these conditions. But, and actually this is the only difference that stood out in this Banks paper. Now, the point about this is that I'm not, as a social epidemiologist, we don't stop at saying we found the answer, it's obesity. Because to a social epidemiologist, that's only half the answer. What we would say then is, well, what caused those differences in obesity between nations? Yeah, so you just change the questions you're asking. And so if you turn the question around to the next one, which is, why are there such national differences in obesity? You would go through the same kinds of routines that I just showed, which is, maybe it's lifestyle, maybe it's genetics, maybe it's in the social environment. What can we say about genetics? There's extensive studies in laboratory animals that suggest that obesity has a strong genetic component. You can breed mice and other kinds of animals to become genetically obese. But can we say that that's the reason for the U.S. obesity epidemic? And I would suggest that's a very difficult thing to conclude based upon just a simple fact of time trends. How many people here have seen the CDC maps of obesity in the USA? This will be, you've already seen this, but I'm going to quickly show what the Centers for Disease Control has been monitoring over the last 20 years to map the rise in the obesity epidemic. So back in 85, there were only a few states in which we had reliable data, and some states had obesity prevalence as high as 10 to 14%. Obesity is defined as, you know, body mass index of 30 units or more. So that's the start of the clock. This is 1986, 87, 88, 89, 90. You get the impression of the spread of the, because you know, more and more states are becoming darker. By 1991, they have to invent a new category to accommodate now states which have 15 to 19% of their population obese. This is 92, 93, 94, 95, 96, 97. They have to extend the legend again to now incorporate states that where more than one in five adults are obese. 98, 99, 2000, 2001. They have to now incorporate for Mississippi the fact that over a quarter of the adult population are obese. 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005, we have to change the color scheme to accommodate a new category where West Virginia, Louisiana, and Mississippi, over a third of the population is obese. 2006, 2007, 2008, that's the latest data. Now, as we say, you know, no population genetics can explain this. You know? I mean, there's not obesity, genetic mutation or genetic drift is not the issue here. It's really an interaction of the environment with the propensity for some people to become obese. We've seen this with consumer products, where you know, I'm not making this up. They really have had to change the width of the car seats to accommodate kids who are being caught up in the obesity epidemic. If you come to Boston well, you can't do this anymore, for this season, but if you had come to Fenway in 1912, the original seats were 15 inches wide, but of course, since 2003, when they started to add new seats, they had to be expanded. Architects now say that they have to plan for wider revolving doors. They used to be routinely 6 feet wide, but now they have to be up to 8 feet wide. At the very end of the life course, I'm not sure people know, recognize what these are. I think it's under the brand name of Goliath caskets that have had to be developed for people who have the misfortune to die of morbid obesity. So these are all, you know, you don't have to look very far to see evidence of the speed, the rapidity with which the epidemic has occurred. And much of that, I would submit, is not genetic in origin. I think the second strand of evidence for suggesting that it's all in the environment is through the immigrant studies that we have. So Gale and others published in JAMA a fascinating analysis of the trends in body mass among immigrants to the USA. And so on the very left-hand axis chart is the trends in normal weight individuals residing in the US. The dark bar is US-born individuals, and the light bars are the immigrants into the country based on their duration of residence in this country. The far left is, you know, immigrants have been here for less than a year. Next one is between 1 to 5, next is 5 to 10. 10 to 15, and finally 15 or more years. And as you look at this drifting downwards, you see that after about between 5 to 10 years of residence, well, after about 10 years of residence, the proportion of immigrants in terms of their prevalence of normal weight equalizes to US-born individuals. If you look at the far right column of the percent of obese individuals, this is the US-born individuals, and you see that you can see the corresponding increase such that after about 10 years of residence in this country, the average immigrant catches up to the US-born individual. And we say, you know, in our field, this is the America 10 effect. I guess it's about taking off the freshman 15, you know. But we say America 10 because it takes, on average, after 10 years of residence in the US, immigrants put on about 10 pounds. That's the average, you know, this is adjusting for age because we all have this tendency to put on weight as we age. Now, what does immigration effect suggest to the social epidemiologist is that it's American society that's toxic, and public health, we now use this term obesogenic. I mean, the environment, something in the environment is very conducive to people gaining weight and being pushed over into the territory of overweight and obesity. Everybody is at risk, and that means that we should stop blaming individuals for or that lacking the ability to lose or control their weight, and start thinking about curing the environment. That's where we've got to in the the obesity epidemic is an excellent illustration of why social epidemiology matters. And so you should stop saying that. These are always posed. These questions are always posed in this way. You know, we say are Americans overweight because they have bad habits. These are I pull these from. From the web of people boasting about walking their dog on the Segway or leash attached to their car, or is it because badly built on physical environments? I thought this was a hoax, but someone told me that this facility actually exists in San Diego. And I guess this may have been built originally to accommodate the people with disability, but obviously this is a badly designed physical environment because it discourages people from taking the stairs. What I'm going to suggest in the next few minutes is that I think thinking the way that social epidemiologists does encourages you to go progressively, what we call upstream, to the sort of the broader determinants of health. If you're interested, for example, in attacking the problem of the obesity epidemic in this country, then you'll get some mileage by focusing on physical activity, diet, and maybe genes. What you do is you'd do individual one-on-one counseling to try to help people to lose weight through eating a more prudent diet and engaging in activity. These are what we call downstream approaches. But taking what I've been saying about the broader determinants of health, this would encourage you to look more upstream to the things that determine and drive these behaviors, like the built environment where people live, and the food environment that we're surrounded by. And if you want to go even more upstream, you would look at patterns of residential segregation, transport policy, and all the other major social drivers of downstream stuff. I'm just going to talk briefly about the kinds of research that's being carried out in public health to look at the obesity epidemic. When we look at the built environment side of things, that includes trying to characterize what we call the walkability of the neighborhoods where people live, zoning restrictions, which either encourage or discourage people to get their activity in the places where they live, and investments in public transport. So let's talk about walkability. This is what geographers call street connectivity. These are two aerial photographs of neighborhoods that have, at the same spatial scale, one on the left-hand side that has what we call high connectivity. The streets tend to be laid out in a grid-like pattern. And in order to traverse these two points shown by the asterisk, it's a relatively short distance by walking at perpendicular angles. The street design on the right-hand side is more typical of the suburban designs with lots of cul-de-sacs, what the urban planners call the lollipop design of our streets, because each of these ends in a dead end. And for example, so if you live on this dead end and this dead end, even though these are two distances that are the same as the crow flies, it's impossible to cut across this distance. You have to go all the way back here and all the way down to make that traverse that same distance. Maybe it'll become clear if I show it in a real aerial photo. So if you live here and let's say your child's friend lives in this house, there's no way to cut across these backyards. What you have to do is to go all the way around to drop your child off. And it's believed now that this kind of design discourages physical activity. I have a little confession to make, which is that I live in a cul-de-sac in Massachusetts, and we did it originally because when our children were still quite young. And you know, my wife and I figured that if you live in a cul-de-sac, there's traffic calming, and you know, as much of that's dangerous in terms of children being struck by passing automobiles. So when they were, you know, up to about the age of 10, they would enjoy going up and down the street on their tricycles or their razors or whatever. And that worked out very well. But then we forgot about the rest of the life course, which is, you know, when they become teenagers, they don't want to ride on a, you know, razor, you know. And with the consequence that my wife and I spend, you know, most of our weekend ferrying them back and forth in our car, you know. Well, partly because I don't want my kids to drive, you know. Nonetheless, the point is, we spend a lot of time in ferrying them back and forth, and as a consequence, they're much less physically active than what a public health person would like them to be. How about going upstream to transport policies? There are huge differences in the transport, public transport investment of England versus the United States. If you look at the 7-day travel diary data from these two countries, you see that of all the trips that people in these countries took during the last week, only 58% of such trips in the UK were on a privately owned vehicle, where either as a driver or a passenger, whereas almost 90% of all personal trips taken in the US are by automobile. And the difference between the two countries arises in the other categories, where the English are much more, 6 times more likely to ride the bus, 3 times more likely to use the rail, much more likely to bike or walk. And I do think that this is simply as a result of the geographical differences between the two countries. I mean, granted, America is a much larger country, so distances can be, you know, wider, but it's also rooted in the history of investments in public transport between the two countries. If you consider the American Omnibus Transport Act, for instance, where Congress, you know, appropriates, I think it was an order of about $80 billion, you know, to improve public transport infrastructure, you'll see that over 90% of that expenditure in this country is spent on improving highways, building bridges, you know, and doing stuff, paving roads, making automobile transport that much easier. And very little is devoted to high-speed railroad networks and other kinds of things that might encourage alternative forms of transport. Okay, so in terms of the food environment, I'm going to mention that we have a long-term trend of increasing portion size, marketing of junk foods, and a time squeeze on American workers that has resulted in increasing reliance on eating out, and particularly eating out at fast food areas. Now, some of these things, if you want to go further upstream, are undoubtedly the result of residential segregation, that not all of us are exposed to the same degree to low-quality food environments and built environments. It's partly because this country is highly residentially segregated, segregated by race as well as by socioeconomic status. And so if we think about Boston, for example, there are enormous differences in obesity across Boston neighborhoods. If you live in the Back Bay, which is a, you know, tony part of Boston, 30% of residents are obese compared to 56% in the community where the Harvard School of Public Health is located. Now, some of these differences are not simply the result of the, you know, characteristics of the residents who live there. Even when we control for the characteristics of residents, these enormous variations persist. And someone did a systematic review of all the neighborhood-based studies and whether they affected people's diet quality. And the conclusions were threefold. One is that if you live in a low-income and minority neighborhood in this country, you tend to have worse access to supermarkets, which we think is a good thing, and you have worse access to healthy food choices. If you live in the same kinds of neighborhoods, you're much more likely to be exposed to the stuff that will increase your risk of obesity, namely fast food outlets and in the shops that do just poorer food choices, and residents to better access to these places, healthier diets, as well as lower levels of obesity. That's also true when we're looking at Boston, at the physical environment as well. One of my graduate students conducted a few years ago a systematic social observation of all of the 200 parks and playgrounds in the city of Boston. We trained grad students essentially to use a 100-item safety checklist used by the Boston city workers to go out and inspect playground equipment. And so what they do is, you know, if you see a swing set, you would calculate the distance between the swing sets because they're supposed to be a regulation size to, you know, distance to prevent entanglement. When the kids come off the swing set, you check whether they land on concrete or on rubber mats. If there's a swing, if there's a slide equipment, you check to make sure that the equipment's not rusted. It doesn't present dangers of entrapment. You know, kids having their clothes caught and being strangled, for example. And when they come off the slide, do they land in concrete or on wood chips? If they land on wood chips, how deep is the wood chip? You know, there are all these 100 items that park inspectors use routinely. And what when we published this in the American Journal of Public Preventive Medicine a few years ago, where we mapped Boston City, what we find is that as you look across neighborhoods of Boston, the higher the concentration of non-white residents, the worse the mean playground safety score. So it's a 100-item checklist. 100 means conforming on all 100 items. 0 means, you know, absolutely failing on every item. And you see that there's a in Mattapan or Roxbury, where the obesity prevalence is over twice as high as in the Back Bay, on average about half of the safety items are met, whereas in the Back Bay, almost 80% are met, and the prevalence of obesity is less. We can't, attribute cause and effect to these associations. But you could begin to tell a story that if you were living in these neighborhoods, it would be much more of a disincentive to go out and get your physical activity and conform to the Surgeon General's advice based upon what sort of built environment you're surrounded by. I guess I want to leave some time for questions. I'll just skip through this. There's some problems in attributing causality in the kinds of studies I'm describing. And we'll just say that in public health, we're trying to deal with these problems by doing a better job of measuring these religious variables like neighborhood residential preference for living in various kinds of neighborhoods. I think I'll just skip this and we'll just say that there are studies that suggest that even when you control carefully for residential preference to live in certain neighborhoods, neighborhoods nonetheless matter. So I'll just finish up at the end. Benita mentioned that I had done some work on increasing inequality in the distribution of income and wealth in this country. And that's, I think, a lot of the residential segregation in this country is driven by those broader trends. Why are rich people clustering with rich people and poor people are being left behind? Part of that is because of the rising distribution, maldistribution of income and wealth that we've observed in this country during the last 25 years. If you look at the Gini coefficient of income distribution, that's a conventional measure that economists use to measure income distribution. You see that in the post-war period, was in this country what we call the period of the Great Compression, because of the GI Bill and other government policies that equalized income and access to resources between Americans of all social classes. But beginning in the mid-1970s, there's been a steady upward march in the extent of income maldistribution in this country. Now, this Gini coefficient is kind of hard to understand, and I don't have the time to explain how we calculate it, but I'll just show one thought experiment that Lawrence Summers, who's the current chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, has come up with. He says, in order to undo the rise in the income inequality since the late 1970s, you'd have to think of it this way. Every household in this country in the top 1% of the income distribution, that means you'd have to be making, on average, $7 million per year. Each of those households would need to write a check for the value of $800,000. and they would send it into the Treasury Department. We would then pool that money and send out a $10,000 stimulus check to every household in the bottom 80% of the income distribution. So pretty much all of you in this room, I'd imagine, you know, would receive that $10,000 stimulus check, because you know, if you make less than $120,000 a year, you're in the bottom 80% of this country. You know? So imagine you, all of you would get a $10,000 check from Uncle Sam. And only then, you know, would this country be as economically equal as we were three decades ago. That's what that Gini coefficient means. There's been an enormous polarization in economic status in this country, which is driving income inequality, the kinds of residential segregation I'm showing. And if you listen to the debates on this subject, you'll hear both sides of the story. One side says this is a good thing. You know, the American dream is partly to succeed and not you have as little government interference in the form of tax payments, and you just live your dream. You know, they'll say that inequality is good because the more fantastically wealthy people there are, the more of a tax base there is. And that means that if you can tax them, we have more money in the public treasury to spend on things like education, healthcare, national parks. I'm not laughing when I say this. When was the last time this happened? And of course, they're saying that the rich invest their incomes, and some of this trickles down to the rest of society. That's the, you know, at least the libertarian defense of income inequality. Of course, I say exactly the opposite. I think income inequality is a social bad because it speeds up residential segregation. When the wealthy pull away from the rest of us, they literally do so in terms of where they live, and that segregates the environments that we're exposed to, and hence the kind of access to services as well as the exposure to obesogenic environments and all the rest of it. And it's literally a secession, I think, of the affluent from the rest of society, which in turn bites back on all of us, because as the rich, you know, begin to segregate themselves, they send their kids to private schools, they get health insurance, they get their own Cadillac or healthcare insurance plans, they don't care about those who aren't covered. And so you get this political pressure building up to cut taxes on those who see no benefit from the amount of payments they make. And that ultimately translates to reduced social spending, erosion of social cohesion, and I have maintained it as a damaging to public health. And though I don't have time to go into it, there's a number of studies that suggest that the more unequal the distribution of income across different areas, this is the case of the US states, the more unequal the income distribution is measured by Gini, the worse is their life expectancy. So this is the log odds of dying, this is the Gini coefficient. In very unequal places like Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, New York, they have a high inequality and higher mortality compared to the more egalitarian states like Utah, Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, Hawaii, and so forth. So, obviously, it's a wide field of the social determinants of health. This subject is still outside the bounds, I would say, of most current discourse on what really drives health. The U.S. discourse, because of the healthcare situation we have, has been dominated by how to improve access to health care, I think we're still some ways to go in trying to have a public discourse about the broader social determinants of health. The World Health Organization has already reached that point, and they have these sort of diagram that shows the kind of upstream way of thinking about health that I've been describing. But I hope that if nothing else, I would have given you some food for thought that if we get healthcare, that's only the beginning of thinking about how can we improve health and for all Americans in the 21st century. Thank you very much.